It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. The right to vote was not in the original version of the U.S. Constitution. In fact, ever since the inception of the Republic, who is allowed to vote in the United States and what those votes mean has been a contentious issue. Even now, we see measures taken at the state level to determine what is required for a voter to cast his or her ballot. Michael Waldman is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. He writes about the history of voting in the U.S. in his book, The Fight to Vote, and he joins us now. Michael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So efforts to suppress the vote go back to the very beginning of the United States. Even when we first started, there was a determination of who should and shouldn't be allowed to vote.
Well, you're exactly right. It turns out we've been fighting over this, and people have had to demand their ability to vote and have their voices heard from the start, and there's always been people fighting on the other side to try to stop that or to limit the impact of that wider democratic participation. And yes, it goes back to the very beginning. At the time of the Revolution and the Constitution, the rule of thumb then was that only white men who owned property could vote. This came down from England as the way it was done. And even at that point, it was controversial. Benjamin Franklin led a working man's revolt during the Revolution in Pennsylvania to get the right to vote for all white men at the time. And in the Constitutional Convention, he blocked every effort that people made to enshrine this property requirement in the Constitution. But people like John Adams thought this could lead to really ruinous change in America. He said, if we expand the right to vote that way, he said, women will demand a right to vote, and lads will think their interests not enough attended to and will think demand the right to vote. And men, he said, without a farthing to their name, will think they have an equal voice in government. Adams said there will be no end of it, and that's basically what happened ever since.
What we think of as the American democratic system of voting isn't something that has been constant. Even something like the secret ballot, that wasn't in place for a lot of our early history. And sometimes when that was brought in, it actually changed voting and changed the access of voting for some people when they had to go and fill out a ballot.
Well, it was one of the interesting things I learned in researching this book. I mean, we expanded the right to vote to working men. We gave it to African Americans, or they won it after the Civil War, and then in effect it was taken away. But some of the big changes in the 1800s for about half the country's history had to do with how people voted. At the beginning, it was in public. There was no secret ballot, and it wasn't a written ballot, and you would declare who you were for. And it was a time of, on the one hand, a lot of violence and sort of mayhem. It was like a football game. It was not, you know, pristine the way we might want voting to be today. On the other hand, it was very participatory. You had very high voter turnout, and one of the reforms that people had to, among other things, avoid people being paid for voting, you know, to vote for one side or another, was to go to the secret ballot and the printed ballot, therefore. And suddenly, you had to be able to read to be able to use the ballot, or at least have access to a printed party ticket that you could use. And you would never think that there would be any downside to having a secret ballot. I mean, I assume, and always have assumed, that was kind of one of the most important things. But it turned out that that was something that helped begin to make participation less, and actually turnout fell.
And some of those ballots, the people that were in charge of printing them didn't give the same ballot to everyone. So somebody might get a ballot that was harder to read or harder to use than others.
Well, until around the turn of the 20th century, political parties would print up the ballots, and they were called tickets, party tickets. You know the phrase, voting the straight ticket. They might give you your ticket, and you would just hand it in, and that would be your vote. And even if you couldn't read, you know, you knew which one was the elephant and which one was the donkey. And there were all kinds of shenanigans and all kinds of ways that there was fraud back then. It, you know, people now talk about voter fraud as a worry, and it's actually used as the justification for a lot of the laws we see nowadays that people like me would argue make it harder for many people to vote. And is there that kind of voter fraud? Right now, there really is not. It's vanishingly rare. In other words, the kind of thing where someone walks into a polling place and pretends to be someone else. Where you see misconduct throughout history has been sort of the insiders, the political parties, or someone controlling the machinery of an election, wanting, in effect, to stuff the ballot box, not voters themselves. So we've cleaned things up in the country in considerable way, measure. That's what part of the progress. But some of the ways we've done it have combined to help dampen turnout so that we have the lowest voter turnout of just about any major democracy.
We're talking with Michael Waldman. He's the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's Law School. Michael, I think people see American voting rights as a continuum of inclusion, but it's gone back and forth. When African-American men got the right to vote, then all of a sudden the system reacted to that with Jim Crow laws. When immigrants formed voting coalitions in the Gilded Age, there were voting restrictions created then. And what's interesting to look at is how sometimes things have taken a step forward and then the reaction to that has made it more restrictive.
You are exactly right. And it often is coming at a time when there's a great deal of demographic change or economic change in the country. And we expanded that right to vote throughout much of the 1800s. And after the Civil War, the 15th Amendment, you mentioned earlier that the original Constitution does not mention a right to vote or enshrine it. But then there have been five separate amendments since then that do. And one of them was the amendment that said you cannot deny the right to vote based on race in the 15th Amendment. And it was a flowering of democracy in the South. You had voter participation rates of 90% among African-American men. Hundreds of them were elected to legislatures, to Congress, to the governorship. But there was a backlash. The Ku Klux Klan and organized violence and sort of cowardly deals basically meant that first informally and then in the Jim Crow constitutions, that right was essentially stripped away. So that as late as 1940, only 3% of African Americans in the South were registered to vote. 3%. And you're right that we all kind of know that story a little bit. But in the North, where now the cities like Chicago or New York were filled with immigrants, and these were controversial to the people who'd been in the country before. They weren't, you know, it wasn't immigrants from Mexico, but it was immigrants from Ireland or Italy. And it was a Protestant country, and these new immigrants were Catholic. And there were all kinds of laws, all kinds of scare and all kinds of laws to make it harder for them to vote. So in the late 1800s, and it was the Gilded Age also, where now for the very first time you had this big, powerful new factor, which was campaign money from the robber barons of that very unequal time. And so that was a period where things really moved visibly backwards. And so it isn't always the case that America only goes forwards. Sometimes we can be on a tipping point and it can look like we're headed in the wrong direction.
Well, let's talk about the direction that voting seems to be going in now or has gone in the last 10 years or so. As you mentioned earlier, there are a bunch of state laws that have gone into place with voter ID, put in place to try to keep impersonation fraud from happening. And you alluded to the fact earlier that impersonation fraud is pretty rare. But what is wrong with voter ID? Who is left out of the picture with these new laws?
Well, you're right. We all know the story of the 20th century where women won the right to vote and African Americans and all Americans in the Voting Rights Act and the great triumphs of the Civil Rights Movement. In the last 10 or 15 years, you've had a great deal of energy devoted to passing laws to make it harder for people to vote. And voter ID laws, they're not the only kinds of laws like this, but a lot of people certainly know them. And what they basically say is you need to have a driver's license or some other very specific form of photo ID to vote. Now, I'm actually not against voter ID. I mean, I'm actually for it. I think people should have to, you know, be who they say they are. I'm against requiring ID that lots of people don't have. And it'll surprise a lot of people to learn that about 11% of eligible voters don't have a driver's license or the similar kind of ID. So these laws, I would argue, and when you hear the people who talk about these laws, who pass them, when you hear them talk when they're not sure anybody else is listening, this is not just some neutral, clean government thing. This is carefully targeted to make it harder for certain people to vote. These laws affect racial minorities, poor people, often college students who don't live at home, and elderly people who maybe don't have a driver's license anymore. They affect some people very specifically. And a great example is the law passed by the state of Texas, which is a voter ID law. And it says that you cannot use your University of Texas ID as a government ID, but you can use your concealed carry gun permit. You know, what a coincidence. Who does that benefit? It's very partisan, and it's very deliberate. And that law, for example, was found three times by a federal court to be racially discriminatory. So these are controversies going on all over the place, cutbacks in early voting and all other kinds of things. But I'll add that just as in the period, you know, we talked about when things kind of went backwards, there was a great response to that called the Progressive Era, where Americans all over the place found new ways to improve democracy. And I think we're sort of at a tipping point now. We've got these new laws. We've got the consequences of something like Citizens United with the billions of dollars of new money from a tiny handful of donors flooding the political system. But you've got a real pushback, too. In Illinois, there's a few things that are being discussed that could make a big difference. Illinois is considering moving to automatic voter registration, which California and Oregon have now started to do in other states, which would mean that, I think in the case of the proposal being considered in Illinois, if you have anything to do with the DMV, you're automatically registered to vote, unless you don't want to be. And this general idea of automatic universal registration would add tens of millions of eligible people to the rolls and cost less and curb fraud.
Michael, I want to ask you about the types of IDs that you think would be the most effective, because let's say that you're in the university system with a student ID in Texas. People come from all over the world to go to school. You can get a student ID if you're from another country, if you're from another state. So I can understand why that wouldn't be necessarily the ID that people would use. What types of IDs?
But they're actually allowed to vote in Texas. They just can't use their ID.
Yeah. So what is the solution? What types of IDs would be best to serve those 11%?
Yeah, the states that have the best systems are, one of the new laws that was just passed was in Rhode Island, and there's a few different kinds of ID that you can use, whether it's a driver's license or a military veterans card or some other government card, or states should give out ID with a photo. I mean, we're one of the only countries that doesn't have a national ID card, and they don't have these issues in other countries where they have that. It costs a bit of money, but if people really are worried about it, that's the way to do it. The problem is right now we make people who don't have the paperwork suddenly no longer full citizens, in effect, until they go spend money they may not have to go get the paperwork. There's even a federal law with about 10 or 11 different kinds of ID. You can use your veterans card. You can use, as long as it's a card given out by the government or like a utility that shows where you live. And again, this is just to show up to vote. To register, it's a more stringent set of rules, which makes sense.
Right. In some places, they ask for a Social Security card that, you know, you might not necessarily know where it is and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it's certainly understandable that people should have to show who they are. And my goodness, in this day and age, we have so many ways to do that. You know, we're going to have to buy new voting machines in this country over the next 10 years because of those electronic gizmos that we all purchased after the Florida recount in 2000. They're all now 15-year-old computers, and so they're all about to break. Nobody wants to hear that, but states or the federal government are going to have to spend some money to buy new systems, and I just wonder why, when we're doing that, we can't integrate it better with the system of checking people in at the polling place. If everybody had an iPad or some other tablet with their photo in it accompanying their voter record, then we wouldn't have any of these problems. So there are so many ways to make it that nobody's disenfranchised. Unfortunately, that is not what some states have chosen to do.
Michael Waldman is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice, and he has written about voting rights in his book, The Fight to Vote. Michael, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. My pleasure. Appreciate it.